Interesting. And the monitors, Kyle?
Basic LCD flat screens.
Let's take a peek,
Nigel said as he opened the notebook to another section, this one filled with an assortment of monitors.
Size, Kyle?
14 inches. Full color display, I'm sure. Yes. Kyle stopped on the third page and pointed. This one is very close.
Excellent, Kyle. And printers?
None.
Nowhere in the room? Not a single printer?
None. Nigel paused to scratch his face and ponder this.
Suppose you're working on a brief or a memo. When it's time to produce it, what happens?
You notify your supervisor, who then enters the room, pulls it up, reviews it, and so on. If it is to be submitted to the court or to the opposing attorneys, it's printed.
Where? I thought there were no printers.
There's a machine in a room next door with a paralegal who monitors the printing. Every sheet of paper that's printed is coded and duplicated. It's impossible to print anything without leaving a trail.
Quite nice, really.
With that, Nigel took a sharp step back and relaxed. Benny took over. Kyle, how many times have you entered the room?
Once a day for the last 5 days.
And how many people are normally in the room?
It varies. Sunday afternoon I was alone for about an hour. This morning there were 5 or 6 others.
Have you been there late at night when they closed the room?
No, not yet.
Do it, okay? Be there at 10 one night.
I can't go there just to hang out, Benny. It's not a coffee room. Surveillance is constant, cameras watching and all that. There has to be a reason to be there other than casing the joint.
Does anyone notice when you come and go?
There's not a guard at the door. The key makes a record of each entry and exit, and I'm sure it's all recorded by closed circuit.
Do you take your briefcase in with you?
No.
Are briefcases forbidden?
No.
Do you wear your jacket?
No. Jackets are not required around the office.
Benny and Nigel studied each other for a minute or so, both minds hard at work.
Will you go there tomorrow? Benny asked. Maybe. I'm not sure right now. It depends on what I'm asked to do in the morning.
I want you to enter the room tomorrow, carrying your briefcase and wearing your jacket. As soon as you're settled in, take off your jacket. Keep the briefcase under the table.
Will this work, Kyle?
Nigel piled on quickly.
Oh, sure. Why not?
Anything else? And what if I haul in a box of tacos and drop cheddar crumbs on the keyboard?
Where is this going?
Just trust us here, Kyle,
Nigel said gently.
We know what we're doing.
You're the last person I'd trust.
Now, Kyle.
Look, I'm tired. I'd really like to go. What are your plans for the next few days? Benny asked.
I'll work tomorrow, leave the office around 5, take the train to Philly, rent a car, and drive to York. I'm having Thanksgiving dinner with my father on Thursday. I'll be back in the city late Friday afternoon and back at the office early Saturday. Good enough?
We'll meet Sunday night, Benny said.
Your place or mine?
I'll pass along the details.
Happy Thanksgiving, boys, Kyle said as he left the room.
On his new office door, Kyle hung 2 waterproof, all-purpose trench coats, one black and the other one a light brown. The black one he wore every day, to and from work and when moving around the city. The brown one was used rarely, only on those occasions when Kyle really didn't want to be followed. At 2:30 on Wednesday, he draped it over his arm and rode the elevator to the 2nd floor. From there, he took a service elevator to the basement, put on the trench coat, and ducked through the rows of thick plumbing pipes and electrical cables and heating units until he came to a metal stairway. He spoke to a technician, one he'd spoken to on several occasions. He saw daylight in a narrow alley that barely separated his building from the 50-story edifice next door. 10 minutes later, he walked into the office of Roy Benedict. They had chatted briefly on the phone, and Kyle was uneasy about the plan. Roy was not at all uneasy. He had studied the file, analyzed the facts and issues, weighed the predicament, and was ready to move.
I have a friend with the FBI, he began. A friend I trust completely. We worked together years ago before I became a lawyer, and even though we are now on opposite sides of the street, I trust him even more. He's a heavyweight here in the New York office.
Kyle flashed back to his last encounter with the FBI,
fake names, fake badges, a long night in a hotel room with Benny.
I'm listening, Kyle said with skepticism.
I want to meet with him and lay everything on the table. Everything.
What will he do?
Crimes have been committed. Crimes are in process. Crimes are being planned. And not small crimes. I suspect he will be as shocked as I am. I suspect the FBI will get involved.
So Benny gets nabbed by the feds?
Sure. Don't you want him locked up?
For life. But he has a vast network out there in the shadows.
The FBI knows how to lay its traps. They screw up occasionally, but their record is very good. I deal with them all the time, Kyle. I know how smart these guys are. If I talk to them now, they'll move in quietly and lay the groundwork. When they want to, they can throw a whole army at the enemy. Right now, you need an army.
Thanks.
I need your permission to talk to the FBI.
Is there a chance they'll take a look and let it pass?
Yes, but I doubt it.
When will you talk to your friend?
Maybe as early as this afternoon.
Kyle barely hesitated.
Let's do it, he said.
Chapter 33. It was almost midnight when Kyle quietly slipped through the unlocked kitchen door of his family home in York. All lights were off. His father knew he would be arriving late, but John McAvoy let nothing interfere with a night's sleep. Zack, the ancient border collie who'd never met an intruder he didn't like, managed to rouse himself from his pillow in the breakfast nook and say hello. Kyle rubbed his head, thankful to see the dog one more time. Zack's age and exact lineage had never been clear. He was a gift from a client, partial payment on a fee, and he liked to spend his days under the desk of John McAvoy, sleeping through all sorts of legal problems. He usually ate lunch in the firm's kitchen with one of the secretaries. Kyle kicked off his loafers, sneaked up the stairs to his bedroom, and within minutes was under the covers and dreaming. Less than 5 hours later, John practically kicked in the door and boomed,
"Let's go, knucklehead. You can sleep when you're dead."
In a drawer, Kyle found an old set of his thermal underwear and a pair of wool socks, and in the closet, among a collection of dusty old clothes that dated back to high school, he pulled out his hunting overalls. Without a woman in the house, the dust and spiderwebs and unused garments were accumulating. His boots were precisely where he'd left them a year earlier, last Thanksgiving. John was at the kitchen table preparing for war. Three rifles with scopes were laid out, next to several boxes of ammo. Kyle, who'd learned the art and rules of hunting as a child, knew his father had thoroughly cleaned the rifles the night before.
"Good morning," John said. "You ready?"
"Yep. Where's the coffee?"
"In the thermos. What time did you get in?"
"Just a few hours ago."
"You're young. Let's go."
They loaded the gear into the late model Ford pickup, four-wheel drive, John's preferred means of transportation in and around York. 15 minutes after crawling out of bed, Kyle was riding through the darkness of a frigid Thanksgiving morning, sipping black coffee and nibbling on a granola bar. The town was soon behind them. The roads became narrower. John was working a cigarette, the smoke drifting through a small crack in the driver's window. He usually said little in the mornings. For a man whose day was spent in the midst of a busy small-town law office, with phones ringing and clients waiting and secretaries scurrying about, John needed the solitude of the early hours. Kyle, though still sleepy, was almost numb with the shock of open spaces, empty roads, no people, the great outdoors. What exactly had been the attraction of a big city? They stopped at a gate. Kyle opened it and John drove through. Then they continued deeper into the hills. There was still no trace of sun in the east.
"So how's the romance?"
Kyle said, finally attempting conversation. His father had mentioned a new girlfriend, a serious one.
"Off and on. She's cooking dinner tonight."
"And her name is?"
"Zoe."
"Zoe?"
"Zoe. It's Greek."
"Is she Greek?"
"Her mother is Greek. Her father is an Anglo mix. She's a mutt, like the rest of us."
"Is she cute?" John thumped ashes out the window.
"You think I'd date her if she wasn't cute?"
"Yes. I remember Rhoda. What a dog."
"Rhoda was hot. You just didn't appreciate her beauty."
The truck hit a rough section of gravel road and bounced them around.
Where's Zoe from?
Reading? Why all the questions?
How old is she?
49, and hot.
You gonna marry her?
I don't know. We've talked about it.
The road went from gravel to dirt. At the edge of a field, John parked and turned off the lights.
Whose property is this?
Kyle asked softly as they gathered their rifles. It used to be owned by Zoe's ex-husband's family. She got it in the divorce. 200 acres, crawling with deer.
Come on.
True. All legal and above board.
And you handled the divorce?
5 years ago. But I didn't start dating her until last year. Maybe it was the year before. I really can't remember.
We're hunting on Zoe's property.
Yes, but she doesn't care.
Ah, the small-town practice of law, Kyle thought to himself. For 20 minutes, they hiked along the edge of the woods without a word. They stopped under an elm tree just as the first hint of light fell across the small valley before them.
Bill Henry killed an 8-point last week just over that ridge there, John said, pointing. There are some big bucks in here. If he can get one, anybody can.
A deer stand had been built in the elm, 20 feet up, with a rickety ladder leading to it.
You take this stand, John said. I'll be 100 yards that way in another one. Nothing but bucks, okay?
Got it.
Is your hunting license current?
I don't think so.
No big deal. Lester's still the game warden. I kept his son out of jail last month. A drug head. Meth.
John walked away, and as he disappeared into the darkness, he said,
You stay awake now.
Kyle tucked the rifle over his shoulder and crawled up the ladder. The deer stand was a small platform made of planks and 2x4s anchored into the elm, and like all deer stands, it was constructed with little thought to comfort. He twisted one way, then another, and finally situated himself with his rear on the planks, his back to the bark, his feet dangling. He'd been in deer stands since he was 5 years old, and had learned the lessons of complete stillness. A soft breeze rustled a few leaves. The sun was rising fast. The deer would soon quietly ease from the woods to the edge of the field in search of fescue and field corn. The rifle was a Remington 30-06, a gift for his 14th birthday. He tucked it firmly across his chest and promptly dozed off. The crack of a gunshot jolted him from his nap, and he swung the rifle around, ready to fire. He glanced at his watch, a 40-minute nap. To his left, in the direction of his father, he saw several white tails bouncing in a rapid getaway. 10 minutes passed with no word from John. He'd obviously missed with his first shot and was still in the stand. An hour passed without a sighting, and Kyle fought to stay awake. Thanksgiving Day. The offices of Scully and Pershing were officially closed, but he knew that a few of the gunners were there, casually dressed in jeans and boots and billing away. There were a few partners hard at work, all with deadlines screaming at them. He shook his head. Sounds were approaching, footsteps unconcerned with making noise. John was soon near the elm.
Let's go, he said. There's a creek just beyond the field, a favorite watering hole.
Kyle lowered himself carefully, and when his feet were on the ground, John said,
You didn't see that buck?
Nope.
I don't know how you missed it. It ran right in front of you.
The one you shot at?
Yeah, at least a 10-pointer.
I guess you missed it, too. They returned to the truck and went for the thermos. As they sat on the tailgate, sipping strong coffee from paper cups and finishing the last of the granola bars, Kyle said, Dad, I don't want to hunt anymore. We need to talk. His father listened calmly at first, then lit a cigarette. As Kyle plowed through the rape investigation, he expected an eruption, a series of sharp and painful questions about why he had not called his father. But John listened intently without a word, as if he knew this story and had been expecting the confession. The first flash of anger came when Benny entered the narrative.
They blackmailed you, he said, then lit another cigarette.
Son of a bitch.
Just listen, okay? Kyle pleaded and went full speed ahead. The details came in torrents, and several times he raised his hand to keep from being interrupted. After a while, John became stoic, absorbing it all in disbelief but saying nothing. The video, Joey, Baxter, the murder, Trilon and Barton and the secret room on the 18th floor, the meetings with Benny, Nigel, the plan to filch the documents and hand them to the enemy, and finally, the hiring of Roy Benedict and the appearance of the FBI. Kyle apologized repeatedly for not trusting his father. He admitted his mistakes, too numerous to recall at that moment. He laid open his soul, and when he finished, hours later it seemed, the sun was well into the sky, the coffee was long gone, the deer long forgotten. "I think I need some help," Kyle said.
"You need your ass kicked for not telling me."
"Yes, I do."
"Good Lord, son. What a mess."
"I had no choice. I was terrified of the video, and the thought of another rape investigation was just too much. If you saw the video, you'd understand."
They left the rifles in the truck and went for a long hike along a narrow trail through the woods. The feast of turkey, dressing, and all the trimmings had been prepared by a deli that sold the whole package to those who preferred not to be troubled. As John set the dining room table, Kyle left to fetch his mother. Patty answered the door with a smile and a long hug. She was up and properly medicated. She escorted Kyle through her apartment and couldn't wait to show off her latest masterpieces. He eventually led her back to the door and down to his rental car, and they enjoyed a quick drive through York. She was wearing lipstick, makeup, and a pretty orange dress that Kyle remembered from his teenage years, and her hair was clean, neat, and almost white. She chattered nonstop with news about locals she'd known years ago, bouncing from one subject to another with a randomness that would have been comical under other circumstances. Kyle was relieved. There'd been an even chance she would be off her meds and out of her mind. His parents greeted each other with a polite hug, and the small, struggling family worked its way through the gossip about the twin daughters, neither of whom had been back to York in over a year. One was in Santa Monica, the other in Portland. They called both and passed around the phone. The television was on in the den, muted, a football game waiting to be watched. At the dining table, Kyle poured 3 glasses of wine, though his mother wouldn't touch it.
"You're drinking wine these days," John said to Kyle as he sat the small turkey on the table.
"Not much." The two men served Patty, fussed over her, worked hard to make her comfortable. She prattled on about her art and about events in York that happened years earlier. She managed to ask a few questions about Kyle and his career in New York, and he made his life sound enviable. The strain from events in New York was palpable, but Patty did not notice. She ate almost nothing, but her son and ex-husband devoured the lunch as quickly as possible. After pecan pie and coffee, she announced she wanted to go home, to her work. She was tired, she said, and Kyle wasted no time loading her up for the 10-minute drive. One football game blurred into another. Kyle, on the sofa, and John, in a recliner, watched the games between naps and said little. The air was heavy with things unsaid, questions that came and went, plans that needed to be discussed. The father wanted to lecture and yell, but the son was too vulnerable, too dependent at that moment. "Let's go for a walk," Kyle said when it was almost dark.
"Walk where?"
"Around the block. I need to talk."
"Can't we talk here?"
"Let's walk." They bundled up and put Zach on a leash. They were on the sidewalk when Kyle said, "I'm sorry, but I don't like to have serious conversations indoors."
John lit a cigarette with the ease of a longtime smoker, perfect coordination without missing a step.
"I'm almost afraid to ask why not."
"Bugs, mics, nasty little twerps listening to conversations?"
"Let me get this straight. You think that my house might be bugged by these thugs?"
They were strolling along the street Kyle had roamed as a child. He knew the owner of every home, at least the owners back then. And every home had a story. He nodded at one and asked, "Whatever happened to Mr. Polk?"
"Dead, finally. Lived in a wheelchair for almost 50 years. Very sad. Back to my question. We're not walking down memory lane here, okay?"
"No, I don't think your house is bugged, nor your office, but there's a chance. These guys believe in surveillance and have an unlimited budget. Bugging is easy.
Ask me, I'm an expert.
I could make a homemade listening device in half an hour with a few items from Radio Shack.
And how did you acquire such knowledge?
Books? Manuals? There's a great little spy store in Manhattan, and I drop in occasionally when I'm able to lose my tail.
This is unbelievable, Kyle. If I didn't know better, I'd say you're cracking up. You sound schizophrenic, like a few of my clients.
I'm not crazy yet, but I've learned to play it safe and have the serious conversations outdoors.
Your apartment is bugged?
Oh, yes. I know of at least three listening devices hidden in the place. One is in the AC vent above the sofa in the den, there's one hidden in the bedroom wall, just above the chest of drawers, and there's one in the kitchen in a door facing. I can't really examine them because there are also three tiny cameras, at least three, that watch me continuously when I'm in the apartment, which is not very often. I've managed to locate these devices by pretending to do all sorts of routine chores around the place, cleaning vents, washing windows, scrubbing floors. The place is a dump, but it's pretty clean.
And your phone?
I still have the old one from law school, and they're listening. That's why I haven't switched. I know they're listening, and so I give them enough harmless crap to make them happy. I installed a landline in the apartment, and I'm sure it's bugged. I haven't been able to inspect it, though, because the cameras are watching. I use it just for harmless stuff, ordering a pizza, bitching at my landlord, calling a car service.
Kyle pulled out the firm phone and glanced at it.
This is the one the firm gave us on day one. I'm pretty sure this one is bug-free.
The question is, why is it in your pocket on Thanksgiving Day?
Habit. It's turned off. For serious stuff, I use the desk phone in my office. I figure that if they can bug the office phones, then we're all really screwed.
Oh, you're screwed. There's no doubt about that. You should have told me months ago.
I know. I should have done a lot of things differently, but I didn't have the benefit of hindsight. I was scared.
Still am.
Zach stopped at a fire hydrant. John needed another smoke. The wind had picked up and leaves were blowing and landing around them. It was dark, and they still had dinner at Zoe's.
They made the block and talked about the future.
Chapter 34. The associates who dared to slack off by leaving for the short holiday break returned with a vengeance early Saturday morning. The time away was refreshing, though the strain of frenzied travel left them even more exhausted. And time off also meant no billing. Kyle punched his clock at 8 a.m. sharp when he entered the secret room on the 18th floor and settled himself at one of the workstations. Four other members of Team Trilon were there, lost in a virtual world of endless research. He nodded to a couple, but no one spoke. He wore jeans and a wool sport coat, and he hauled in his black Bally briefcase, 6 inches thick and showing some wear. He'd bought it at a shop on Fifth Avenue a week before orientation. All briefcases at the firm were black. He placed it on the floor beside him, partially under the table, directly under the plain vanilla computer that had so captivated dear Nigel. He withdrew a legal pad, then a file, and before long his workstation looked authentic. After a few minutes, he took off his jacket, hung it on the back of his chair, and rolled up his sleeves. Trilon was now paying old Scully an additional $400 an hour. A quick look around the room revealed one other briefcase. All other jackets and coats had been left upstairs in the offices. The hours began to drag by as Kyle lost himself in the futuristic world of the B-10 hypersonic bomber and the people who designed it. The only good thing about the secret room was the prohibition against cell phones. After a few hours, Kyle needed a break, and he wanted to check his messages. Specifically, he was waiting to hear from Dale, who hadn't bothered to show up on such a beautiful morning. He walked to his office, closed the door, which was a minor violation of firm policy, and called her private cell phone. As a refuge from the much-hated firm phone, every associate carried a private one as well.
Yes, she answered.
Where are you?
I'm still in Providence.
Are you coming back to New York?
I'm not sure.
Need I remind you, young lady, that this is the third consecutive day in which you have not billed a single hour?
I take it you're at the office.
Yes, racking up hours along with every other first-year grunt. Everyone's here but you.
Fire me. Sue me. I don't care.
You'll never make partner with that attitude.
Promise? I was thinking about dinner tonight. There's a new restaurant in the East Village that just got 2 stars from Frank Bruni.
Are you asking me out for a date?
Please? We can split the check since we work for a gender-neutral firm.
You're so romantic.
We could do the romance later.
So that's what you're really after?
Always.
I get in around 7. I'll call you then.
Kyle clipped Trilon for 12 hours, then called a sedan for the ride to dinner. The restaurant had 20 tables, a Turkish menu, and no dress requirement, though jeans were preferred. After the 2-star review by the Times, the place was crowded. Kyle got a table only because there had been a cancellation. Dale was at the bar sipping white wine and looking almost serene. They kissed, a peck on each cheek, then squeezed together and started talking about their Thanksgiving holidays as if they'd just had a month at the beach. Both of her parents taught mathematics at Providence College, and though wonderful people, they had a rather dull existence. Dale's gift for math led to a relatively quick PhD, but she began to fear she'd wind up much like her parents. The law beckoned her. The law, as portrayed in film and on television as nonstop excitement. The law, as the cornerstone of democracy and the front lines for so many social conflicts. She had excelled at law school, received offers from the top firms, and now, after 3 months of practice, she sorely missed mathematics. Later, at their table and still sipping wine, she was quick to confess some exciting news.
I had a job interview this morning.
I thought you had a job.
Yes, but it sucks. There's a boutique firm in Providence, downtown in a beautiful old building. I got a job there one summer while I was in college, making copies and coffee and doing the general gopher routine. About 20 lawyers, half women, a general practice. I talked them into an interview on a Saturday morning.
But you have a cherished associate's position with the largest firm in the world. What more could you want?
A life? The same thing you want?
I want to be a partner so I can sleep until 5 a.m. every day until I die at 50. That's what I want.
Look around, Kyle. Very few stay more than 3 years. The smart ones are gone after 2. The crazy ones make a career out of it.
So you're leaving?
I'm not cut out for this. I thought I was pretty tough, but you can have it.
The waiter took their orders and poured more wine. They were side by side, in a narrow half booth with a view of the restaurant. Kyle's hand was between her knees under the table.
When are you leaving? He asked. As soon as humanly possible.
I practically begged for a job this morning. If I don't get an offer, I'll keep knocking.
This is madness, Kyle, and I'm checking out.
Congratulations. You'll be the envy of our class.
What about you?
I have no idea. I feel as though I just got here. We're all in shock, but it'll wear off. It's boot camp, and we're still sore from the initial bruising.
No more bruises for me. I've collapsed once. It won't happen again.
I'm slacking off to 50 hours a week, and I dare them to say something. Go, girl.
A platter of olives and goat cheese arrived, and they toyed with it.
How was York? She asked.
The same. I had lunch with my real mother and dinner with my next one, a quick deer hunt that killed nothing, and some long talks with my dad.
About what?
The usual. Life. The past. The future.
Nigel was present for the second meeting in a row, and long before Kyle arrived in the hotel suite, preparations had been underway. On a small desk, Nigel had set up a computer that looked very similar to those on the 18th floor. Next to it was a monitor that was identical to the one Kyle had stared at for 12 hours the day before.
Are we close here, Kyle?
Nigel was singing away as he proudly revealed his copycat workstation.
Please have a seat.
Kyle sat at the desk, with Benny and Nigel watching every move.
It looks very similar, Kyle said.
Just the hardware here, Kyle, as you know. Not crucial, but we're trying to pinpoint the manufacturer, that's all. Only the software matters, we know that. Are we off the mark?
Neither the computer nor the monitor had markings or names or models or makers. They were as blandly generic as the ones they were trying to imitate.
These are very close, Kyle said.
Look hard, man, and find something different, Nigel pressed.
He was beside Kyle, bent and staring at the screen. The computer is slightly darker in color, almost a gray, and it's 16 inches wide and 20 inches tall.
You measured, Kyle?
Obviously. I used a 15-inch legal pad.
Bloody brilliant!
Nigel exclaimed, and seemed ready to hug Kyle. Benny couldn't hide a smile.
It has to be a Fargo,
Nigel said. A what?
Fargo, Kyle. A specialty computer company in San Diego. Big on government and military machines. Tons of work for the CIA. Big, stout computers with more security and more gadgets than you can believe. I assure you of that. You won't see one at the local mall, no sir. And Fargo is owned by Dean, a client of you-know-who. Old Scully protects its ass at $1,000 an hour.
As Nigel chirped away, he hit a button on the keyboard. The screen became a page unlike any Kyle had ever seen. Nothing from Microsoft or Apple.
Now, Kyle, tell me what the first page looks like. Anything remotely similar here?
No, not even close. The home page has one icon for the tutorial, but that's it. No other icons, message boards, edit bands, format options, nothing but an index to the documents. You turn the computer on, get through the passcodes and passwords, then wait about 10 seconds, and presto, you're into the library. No system profiles, no spec sheets, no home page.
Fascinating,
Nigel said, still staring at the monitor.
And the index, Kyle?
The index is a real challenge. It starts with broad divisions of documents, then it breaks down into subcategories and subgroups and sub-this and sub-that. It takes some work to find the batch of documents you're looking for. Nigel took a step back and stretched.
Benny moved closer and said, Suppose you wanted to locate the research materials relating to the B-10's air-breathing engines and the various types of hydrogen fuel that were tested. How would you get there?
I don't know. I haven't been there yet. I've seen nothing about air-breathing engines.
The statement was true, but Kyle decided to draw a line at this point. With over 4 million documents in play, he could easily claim he had not seen whatever they were curious about.
But you could find these materials?
I could find them quickly once I knew where to look. The Sonic program is pretty fast, but there's a ton of paper to sift through.
Benny's movements were quick, his words a little more urgent than usual. Nigel was downright giddy with Kyle's information. It was obvious that his progress had them agitated.
You were in the room yesterday? Benny asked.
Yes, all day.
With a briefcase and a jacket?
Yes, both, no problem. There was one other briefcase. No one checks them.
When will you return to the room? Benny asked.
The team meets in the morning, and there's a good chance I'll get another assignment. Monday or Tuesday for sure.
Let's meet Tuesday night.
Can't wait.
Chapter 35. Now that he was an official member of Team Trilon, Kyle had the honor of beginning each week with a 7 a.m. Monday chalk talk in a huge conference room he'd never seen before. After 3 months in the building, he still marveled at the meeting areas and balconies and tucked away mezzanines and small libraries he was stumbling upon for the first time. The firm needed its own guidebook. The room was on the 41st floor and large enough to house many smaller law firms. The table in the center seemed as long as a bowling alley. 40 lawyers, give or take a few, crowded around it, gulping coffee and settling in for another long week. Wilson Rush stood at the far end and cleared his throat, and everyone shut up and froze.
Good morning. We'll have our weekly session. Keep your comments brief. This meeting will last for 1 hour only.
There was no doubt that they would leave at exactly 8 a.m.
Kyle was as far from Rush as possible. He kept his head low and took furious notes that no one, not even himself, could have read afterward. Each of the 8 partners stood in turn and gave succinct updates on such gripping topics as the latest motions filed in the case, the latest haggling over documents and experts, the latest moves by Ape and Barton. Doug Peckham presented his first report on a complicated discovery motion. It almost put Kyle and the others to sleep. But Kyle stayed awake, and while scribbling on a legal pad, he kept telling himself not to smile at the absurdity of the moment. He was a spy, perfectly planted by his handler, and now within reach of secrets that were so important he could not comprehend their value. They were certainly valuable enough to cause men to commit murder. Kyle glanced up as Isabel Gaffney took her turn on the floor, and ignoring her words, he looked at the far end of the bowling lane, where Wilson Rush seemed to be glaring at him. Maybe not. There was so much distance between them, and the old man was wearing reading glasses, so it was hard to tell exactly whom he was frowning at. What would Mr. Rush do if he knew the truth? What would Team Trilon and the hundreds of other Scully partners and associates do when they learned the truth about young Kyle McAvoy, former editor-in-chief of the Yale Law Journal? The consequences were horrifying. The magnitude of the conspiracy caused Kyle's heart to hammer away. His mouth became dry, and he sipped lukewarm coffee. He wanted to leap for the door, sprint down 41 flights of stairs, and run through the streets of New York like a madman. During lunch, he used the basement exit ploy and hustled over to the office of Roy Benedict. They chatted for a minute or two. Then Roy said there were two people Kyle should meet. The first was his contact in the FBI. The second was a senior lawyer in the Department of Justice. Kyle nervously agreed, and they walked next door to a meeting room. The FBI supervisor was Joe Bullington, an affable sort with a big toothy smile and hearty handshake. The man from Justice was Drew Wingate, a sour-faced sort who acted as though he preferred not to shake hands at all. The four sat at a small conference table, Kyle and Roy on one side, the government guys on the other. It was Roy's meeting, and he took charge. First of all, Kyle, how much time do you have?
About an hour.
I've laid it all on the table. I've had a dozen conversations with Mr. Bullington and Mr. Wingate, and it's important now for us to review where we are. Joe, talk about the background on Mr. Benny Wright. Always smiling, Bullington squeezed his hands together and began,
Yes, right, well, we ran the photo of this guy through our system. I won't bore you with the details, but we have some very sophisticated computers that store facial images of millions of people. When we feed in a suspect, the computers search and scan and, in general, do their thing. With Mr. Wright, or whoever he is, we came up with nothing. No hit, no clue. We then sent it to the CIA, and they conducted a similar search, different computers, different software, same result. Nothing. We're surprised, frankly. We were pretty confident we could identify this guy.
Kyle was not surprised, but he was disappointed.
He'd read about the supercomputers used by the intelligence services, and after a lifetime of living with Benny, he really wanted to know who he was.
Bullington brightened a bit and went on,
Nigel might be a different story. We placed your composite of him into our system and came up empty, but the CIA got a probable hit.
Bullington opened a file, pulled out an 8x10 black and white, and handed it to Kyle, who immediately said, That's him.
Good. His real name is Derry Hobart. Born in South Africa, raised in Liverpool, trained as a techie in the British intelligence services, got bounced 10 years ago for hacking into the confidential files of some rich folks in Switzerland, generally regarded as one of the most brilliant hackers in the world. Brilliant, but a real rogue, a hired gun, warrants outstanding in at least 3 countries.
How much have you told these people? Wingate asked. It was more of an accusation than a question.
Kyle looked at his lawyer, who nodded and said, Go ahead, Kyle. You're not under any type of investigation. You've done nothing wrong.
I've given them the layout of the computer room, general stuff like that. Enough to keep them happy, but no data whatsoever.
Anyway, Bullington said, the other two composites turned up nothing. If I understand things, these two boys are just part of the surveillance and not that important.
That's right, Kyle said.
Your composite of Mr. Hobart is remarkable, Kyle, Bullington said.
It's from a website, quickface.com. Anybody could do it.
What's your next step? Wingate asked.
We meet tomorrow night for an update. The plan is for me to somehow hack into the system, either download or divert the documents and hand them over. I have no idea how this is supposed to be done. The computer system looks completely secure.
When is this supposed to happen?
They haven't told me, but I get the impression it will be soon. I have a question for you.
Neither Bullington nor Wingate offered to take the question, so Kyle plunged ahead.
Who are these guys? Who are they working for?
Bullington flashed all of his teeth and said with a boyish shrug,
"We honestly don't know, Kyle.
Hobart is a whore who travels the world selling himself. We have no clue where Benny comes from. You say he's not American.
He doesn't sound like it.
Without an idea as to who he is, we can't even begin to guess who he's working for."
There were at least 5 agents involved in the first encounter, back in February, the night I first met Benny. All 5 were definitely Americans.
Bullington was shaking his head. "Probably hired guns, Kyle. Thugs brought in for the job, paid, turned loose. There's a whole dark world out there of former cops and agents and former soldiers and intelligence types who got shoved out for a multitude of reasons. Most are misfits. They were trained in the shadows, and that's where they work. They'll hire on with anyone who will pay them. Those 5 probably had no idea what Benny was up to."
"What are the chances of catching the ones who killed Baxter Tate?"
The smile went away for a moment. Both government faces looked sad and perplexed. Bullington finally said, "First we have to catch Benny. Then we work our way up to the big boys who are paying him. Then we'll work our way down to the street thugs who do his dirty work. If he's a pro, though, and it's quite obvious that he is, the chances of squeezing him for names are pretty slim."
"How do you catch Benny?"
"That's the easy part. You'll lead us to him."
"And you arrest him?"
"Oh, yes. We'll have enough warrants to arrest him 10 times. Wiretapping, extortion, conspiracy, take your pick. We'll throw him under the jail, with Hobart as well, and no federal judge in the world will bond him out. We'll probably move him to a secured facility far away from New York so we can begin the interrogation."
The image of Benny chained to a chair as a couple of pit bulls screamed at him was rather pleasant.
Roy cleared his throat, glanced at his watch, and said, "If you'll excuse us, I need to talk to Kyle. I'll call you later." And with that, Kyle stood, shook their hands again, and followed his lawyer back to his office. Roy closed the door and said, "What do you think?"
"You trust those guys?" Kyle shot back.
"Yes, you don't."
"Would you trust them with your life?"
"Yes."
"Try this scenario. Currently, there are at least 18 intelligence outfits in this country, and those are just the ones on paper. There are probably a few more we know nothing about. What if Benny works for one of them? Suppose his project is just one of several to procure and protect all the secrets. What if the supercomputers couldn't find his face because they weren't supposed to?"
"That's a pretty ridiculous scenario, Kyle. A rogue operative working for the United States, spying on a U.S. law firm, killing U.S. citizens? I don't think so."
"Sure, it's ridiculous. But when your skull might be the next target, it does wonders for the imagination."
"Take it easy. This is your only way out."
"There's no way out."
"Yes, there is. Let's take it one step at a time. Don't panic."
"I haven't panicked in 9 months, but I'm getting close."
"No, you're not. Be cool. We have to trust those guys."
"I'll call you tomorrow."
Kyle grabbed his brown trench coat and left the office. Chapter 36.
The Cessna 182 was owned by a retired doctor who flew it only in clear weather and never at night. He had known John McAvoy for over 40 years and had flown him several times around the state for legal matters. Their little trips were as much pleasure as business, with John wearing a headset and taking the controls and thoroughly enjoying his time as the pilot. They always haggled over the rate. John wanted to pay more than just the fuel costs, and the doctor demanded less because flying was his hobby and he didn't need the money. Once they agreed on the cost of the trip, $250, they met at the York Airport early on Tuesday morning and took off in perfect weather. 71 minutes later, they landed in Scranton. John rented a car, and the doctor left in the Cessna to drop in on his son in Williamsport. The law office of Michelin Chiz was on the second floor of an old building on Spruce Street in downtown Scranton. John walked in promptly at 9 a.m. and was greeted coolly by a secretary. He had never met Ms. Chiz, never heard of her, but that was not unusual in a state with over 60,000 lawyers. A Scranton lawyer he did know had told him that she ran an all-woman shop with a couple of associates, a couple of paralegals, and the usual assortment of secretaries and part-time help. No men need apply. Ms. Chiz specialized in divorce,
custody, sexual harassment, and employment discrimination, all from the female side, and had a busy practice. Her reputation was solid. She was a tough advocate for her clients, a good negotiator, and not afraid of the courtroom. Not bad-looking, either, the lawyer had informed John. And he was right about that. Ms. Chiz was waiting in her office when John walked in and said good morning. She was wearing a black leather skirt, not too short, with a tight purple sweater and a pair of black and purple spiked-heeled platform slingbacks that most hookers would shy away from. She was in her mid-40s, with, according to John's source, at least 2 divorces under her belt. She wore a lot of jewelry and makeup, far too much for John's taste, but he wasn't there to evaluate the talent. For his part, he was wearing a boring gray wool suit and a plain red tie. Nothing anyone would remember. They settled around a small work table in a room adjacent to her office, and the secretary was sent for coffee. They played a few minutes of Who Do You Know, kicking around the names of lawyers from Philadelphia to Erie. After the coffee was served and the door was closed, Ms. Chiz said, "Let's get down to business."
"Great idea," Mr. McAvoy said. "Please call me John."
"Sure, and I'm Mike. Don't know if that's the correct nickname for Michelin, but it stuck a long time ago."
"Mike it is."
So far, she had exuded nothing but charm and hospitality, but John could already tell that just behind the smile was a very tough lawyer.
"Would you like to go first?" John asked.
"No, you called me. You traveled here. There's something you want, so let's have it."
"Very well. My client is my son. Not the best arrangement in the world, but that's the way it is. As you know, he works for a law firm in New York. Law school at Yale, undergrad at Duquesne. I'm sure you know the details of the alleged rape."
"Indeed I do. Elaine works here part-time, and we're very close. She wants to go to law school someday."
"I hope she succeeds. As you know, the police in Pittsburgh closed the investigation not long after they opened it. Frankly, I knew nothing about it until very recently."
Her surprise was obvious, and John continued,
"No, Kyle did not tell me when it happened. He was planning to, but the investigation was closed. This is upsetting, because we are very close, but it's not important. I understand that you and Ms. Keenan met with Joey Bernardo here in Scranton a few weeks back, and the meeting did not go well, according to Joey's version. I also know that Baxter Tate contacted your client and was evidently on his way here to talk to her when he was murdered."
"That's correct."
"They were planning to meet?"
"Yes."
"So, it appears, Mike, that the episode 5.5 years ago will not go away. My client would like to resolve things, to close this matter. It's a dark cloud hanging over these kids, and I'm here to explore ways to get rid of it. I'm representing only my son. The others know nothing of this meeting. The Tate family, of course, has no clue, and you can imagine what they're going through right now. Joey has a child on the way and is about to get married. Alan Strock, as far as we know, has forgotten the episode."
Mike had yet to lift a pen. She listened intently as she softly tapped all 10 fingertips together. Most fingers were adorned with rings, and both wrists were laden with inexpensive bangles. Her hard hazel eyes did not blink. "I'm sure you have something in mind," she said, content to listen. "I'm not sure what your client wants. She might be thrilled if all 3 surviving roommates admitted there was a rape, got themselves convicted, and were sent off to prison. She might be satisfied with a quiet apology. Or she might entertain the idea of a financial settlement. Perhaps you could help me here." Mike licked her lipstick and rattled some bracelets. "I've known Elaine for 2 years. She has a troubled past. She's frail, vulnerable, and at times subject to some very dark moods. It might be depression. She's been sober for almost 1 year, but she's fighting those demons. She's become almost like a daughter to me, and she has insisted from 1 that she was raped. I believe her. She is convinced that the Tate family got involved, leaned on their friends, who leaned on the cops, who quickly backed off."
John was shaking his head. "That's not true. None of the 4 boys told their parents."
"Maybe, but we don't know that for sure. Regardless, many of Elaine's problems stem from that episode.
She was a healthy, fun-loving, vibrant co-ed who loved college and had big plans. Shortly after the rape, she dropped out and has been struggling ever since.
Have you seen her grades from Duquesne?
No.
Her first semester, she flunked one course, dropped out of another, and made horrible grades in the other three.
How did you gain access to her student records?
She improved slightly the second semester and made straight C's. She took all four exams after the alleged rape, then went home and never returned to Duquesne.
Mike's eyebrows arched and her spine stiffened. How did you gain access to her student records? She snarled again.
Ah, the woman had a temper after all.
I didn't, and it's not important. How often do your clients tell you the entire truth?
Are you suggesting Elaine is lying?
The truth is a moving target here, Mike. But what's certain is that we'll never really know for sure what happened that night. These kids had been drinking and smoking pot for 8 straight hours, and they were far more promiscuous than we'd like to believe. Your client was known to sleep around.
They were all sleeping around. That's no excuse for rape.
Of course not.
Money was in the air.
There were a few other obstacles to clear, but both lawyers knew they would eventually discuss the possibility of a financial settlement.
What does your client say about the episode?
Mike asked, her tone cool again. The flash of anger was gone, but there was a lot more where that came from. They had been by the pool all afternoon, then the party moved indoors, into the apartment. There were about 15 kids, more boys than girls, but Elaine was not in the group. Evidently, she was next door at a different party. Around 11:30, the cops showed up and the party ended. Nobody was arrested. The cops gave them a break. Mike nodded patiently. This was all in the police report. After the cops left, John continued, Elaine showed up. She and Baxter started making out on the sofa, and one thing led to another. My client was watching television in the same room, as was Alan Strock. My client was intoxicated, to say the least, and at some point he passed out. He is certain he did not have sex with Elaine that night, and at the time he was not certain if anyone else did either. He was too drunk to remember much the next morning, and as you well know, no accusation was made by your client until 4 days later. The police investigated the matter. All four boys were on the verge of talking to their parents, but the investigators soon realized that they simply could not put together a case. In recent weeks, my client has talked to Baxter Tate and to Joy Bernardo, and both boys admitted to having sex with your client on the evening in question. Both were, adamant that it was consensual.
Then why was Baxter so anxious to apologize?
I can't answer that. I don't speak for Baxter.
Why did Joey apologize? He did so in my presence, you know.
Did Joey apologize for raping Elaine, or did he apologize for the misunderstanding?
He apologized. That's what's important.
There's still no case, and his apology adds nothing to the evidence. There's no way to prove rape occurred. There was sex, sure, but you can't prove anything else.
She finally wrote something. Lavender legal pad, elegant strokes, noisy wrists. She took a deep breath and seemed to gaze out the window for a moment. For Team McAvoy, it was time for the biggest gamble. They would never reveal every fact, because successful negotiation does not hinge on full disclosure. But the one bomb that could wreck any deal had to be addressed.
Have you talked to the detectives in Pittsburgh? John asked.
No, but I've read the entire file.
Anything mentioned about a video?
Yes, there were notes in the file, but the cops couldn't find one.
Elaine even heard the rumor. It's not a rumor. There is such a video.
She took this without the slightest flinch. Nothing in her eyes, hands, or body registered surprise.
What a great poker face, John admitted quickly.
She simply waited.
I haven't seen it, he said. But my client saw it in February of this year. Don't know where it is now, and don't know how many others have seen it. Probably very few. There's a chance it might surface, perhaps on the internet, perhaps in your mailbox.
And what would this video prove?
It would prove that your client was drunk and smoking pot when she sat down on the sofa with Baxter Tate and began kissing and groping. The angle of the camera does not allow a full picture of the two engaged in sex,
but it's obvious from the knees down that they're having a fine time. Baxter is followed by Joey. At times, Elaine is not active. At other times, she's obviously engaged. My client thinks it proves that she was in and out of consciousness, but he's not certain. Nothing is certain, except that neither he nor Alan Strock had sex with her.
Where is the video?
I do not know.
Does your client?
No.
Who has the video?
I do not know.
Okay. Who showed it to your client?
He does not know the person's real name. He had never met the person until the person showed him the video.
Gotcha. I take it there's a complicated story behind this.
Extremely complicated.
A stranger pops up, shows your son the video, then disappears?
Right. Except for the disappearance part. The stranger is still in contact.
Extortion?
Something close.
Is that why you're here? Your client is scared of the video? You want to make peace with us so the extortion scheme goes away?
You're very astute.
She still had not blinked. She seemed to be reading his mind at this point.
Must be a hell of a video, she said. My client found it troublesome, though he was not present during the sex portion of it. The video clearly shows your client happily getting involved in a good romp on the sofa. Whether she blacked out at some point is not clear, at least on the video.
She is seen walking and talking and moving around?
Clearly. These boys didn't drag her in off the street, Mike. She had been in their apartment many times, drunk and sober.
Poor thing, Mike said. Her first false move.
Poor thing was having a wonderful time. She carried a purse full of drugs along with her collection of fake IDs, and she was always looking for a party.
Mike slowly stood and said, "Excuse me for a moment." She walked into her office, and John admired the black leather every step of the way. He heard her low voice, probably on the phone, and then she was back with a forced smile. "We could debate this for hours," she said, "and not settle anything."
"I agree. Baxter was in New York 3 weeks ago today to see my client. In the course of a long discussion about what happened, he told my client that he believed that he had forced himself on Elaine. The guilt was heavy. Maybe there was a sexual assault."
"And the rapist is dead."
"Exactly. However, my client was there when it happened. It was his apartment, his friends, his party, and his booze. He wants this thing off his back, Mike."
"How much?"
John managed a nervous laugh. Such bluntness. She, however, did not crack a smile.
He made a note and asked,
"Is it possible to reach a financial settlement and have your client release all civil claims and agree not to prosecute?"
"Yes, assuming the settlement is sufficient."
A pause as John made some more notes. Then, "My client does not have a lot of money."
"I know how much your client earns. I've been practicing law for 20 years, and he earns more than me."
"And me, after 35 years. But he has student loans, and it's not cheap living in New York City. I'll probably need to chip in a little, and I'm not a wealthy man. I don't owe anything, but a busy street practice in downtown York is not the road to riches."
His honesty disarmed her for a moment, and she smiled and seemed to relax. They enjoyed a nice diversion, swapping stories about the challenges of practicing law in small-town America. When the time was up, John said warmly, "Tell me about Elaine.
Job, salary, finances, family, and so on."
"Well, as I said, she works part-time here for peanuts. She makes $24,000 a year as an assistant director of parks and rec for the city, not exactly a career job. She rents a modest apartment that she shares with her companion, Beverly, and drives a Nissan with a monthly note. Her family is from Erie, and I don't know how prosperous they once were, but things have taken a bad turn. She's on her own, 23 years old, surviving. She still has dreams of something beyond where she is now."
John made a few notes, then said, "Yesterday I spoke with an attorney for the Tate family, big firm in Pittsburgh. Baxter had a trust that sent him $6,000 a month, which was never enough. That sum would increase over time, but all the Tate trusts are now tightly controlled by an uncle who has a rather heavy hand. Baxter's trust folded when he died. There's very little in his estate,
so any contribution from his family would fall under the category of charitable giving. These people are not known for their charity, and it's hard to imagine them entertaining notions of writing checks to Baxter's old girlfriends. Mike was nodding in agreement.
What about Joey? She asked.
He's working hard, trying to provide for a growing family. He's probably strapped, and will be for the rest of his life. My client would like to keep both Joey and Alan Strock out of this.
That's admirable.
We propose two payments, one now and one in 7 years, when the statute of limitations expires on the rape charge. If your client puts this behind her, gives up the idea of pursuing these guys, then she gets a nice payment at the end. $25,000 now, and for the next 7 years, my client will add $10,000 to an investment account that will render $100,000 when Elaine is 30 years old. Same poker face.
$25,000 up front is ridiculous, she said.
He doesn't have $25,000. It'll come from me.
We're not too concerned about where it comes from. We're much more interested in the amount.
Well, right now you have zero, and if we don't reach an agreement, then it's very likely you'll stay at zero. Your chances of recovery are slim at best.
Then why are you offering anything?
Peace of mind.
Mike, come on. Let's put this baby to sleep so these kids can get on with their lives.
Kyle had almost forgotten the incident. Hell, he's working 100 hours a week. Then Joey bumps into Elaine. Then Baxter shows up all consumed with guilt because he remembers more now than he did before. This is crazy. They were just a bunch of drunk kids.
Yes, they were. And Mike couldn't argue the point.
She recrossed her legs, and John was compelled to glance at the high heels. Just a quick down and up. But she noticed it.
Let me talk to Elaine, and we'll make a counteroffer, she said.
Fine, but there's not much wiggle room here, Mike. The upfront money will be a loan from me to my client, and he's obviously nervous about taking on a 7-year obligation. He's 25 and can't see 3 years down the road.
I'll call Elaine, and she'll probably want to run over and discuss this face to face.
I'm not leaving town until we have a deal. I'll just walk down to the coffee shop and kill some time.
An hour later, he was back. They took their same positions, picked up their pens, and continued the negotiations.
I assume you're not taking our offer, John said.
Yes and no. The 7-year scheme is okay, but Elaine needs more up front. She is 2 years away from her degree at the University of Scranton. Her dream is law school, and without some help, it will be impossible.
How much help?
$100,000 now.
Shock. Disbelief, amazement, rejection. John grimaced and squirmed and allowed a lungful of air to whistle over his teeth.
It was all an act, the long-practiced pretense of utter incredulity when the other side puts its first demand on the table. Exasperation, near defeat.
Look, Mike, we're trying to reach an agreement here. You guys are trying to rob a bank.
In 2 years, Elaine will still be earning $24,000 a year. Your client, on the other hand, will be earning about $400,000 with guaranteed increases. This is not a stretch for him.
John stood as if he were leaving. End of negotiations. I need to call him.
Sure. I'll wait.
John walked outside the building, put a cell phone to his head, and called no one. The amount they would pay had less to do with what Elaine needed and much more to do with keeping her quiet. $100,000 was a bargain. Under the circumstances. We'll go $75,000, and that's it, John said, back at the table.
Her right hand rattled pleasantly as it came across. Deal, she said.
They shook on their agreement, then spent 2 hours haggling over the paperwork. When it was finished, he offered to buy lunch, and she readily accepted. Chapter 37 Nigel's latest workstation had been hastily assembled on a fine mahogany desk in the center of the sitting room in a spacious suite at the Waldorf Astoria on Park Avenue. The computer was a 16-by-20-inch exact replica of the 10 models on the 18th floor. The monitor, too, was a perfect match. Next to it was an ominous navy blue box the size of a larger laptop. As Nigel proudly went through a detailed description of the various cords and cables, the spaghetti, as he called it, Benny and Kyle watched without a word. There was a power cord,
audio, monitor, and printing cables.
Audio, Kyle. Do we have noise from these bad little boys?
No, no audio, Kyle replied. And Nigel carefully rolled up the audio cable and put it away. He bent low behind the computer and pointed to the magic spot.